There's a lot to consider when building an AI solution for the enterprise. And to paraphrase an old maxim, to better understand where you're going, it's good to know where you've come from. Today, I'll be talking with Catherine Hume, currently the VP of Product and Strategy at Integrate.ai. Catherine started her career consulting with legal firms around compliance. Later, she became quite renowned working as part of Hillary Mason's senior leadership team at Fast Forward Labs. Her journey today, the evolution of machine learning and AI, and we'll be making a few stops along the way at ethics, transparency, and privacy. I'm John Pryle, and welcome to the Impact Podcast. Welcome, Catherine. Glad to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
So I didn't mention this in the intro, but after your consultancy work, you became a professor teaching courses on technology and the law. You were focusing on how emerging technologies are shifting legal practices and ethics. And there's lots of new ethical and legal problems there. So what are some of the key issues that you were focusing on there?
My first job after graduate school was to work for a legal software company called Intapp. And we were focused on all of the risk management issues that law firms faced. And in particular, how new information technologies were challenging traditional notions of professional responsibility and legal ethics, which is basically, as a lawyer, things get totally strange. So in our day-to-day existence, we represent ourselves and we might take care of our family and take care of our friends, but we don't have any zealous advocacy position towards another person, where as a lawyer, right, you're advocating for another person. So you literally have to represent their interest. And when one shifts into the domain where those interests are represented and leaving traces in electronic information, that leads to all sorts of crazy stuff. So managing conflicts of interest, who should have access to which information, where it flows, how you might be able to take confidential document and try to de-anonymize it, and then do knowledge management, which transforms into AI right down the line, and learn things from past precedent became a huge challenge for law firms and young lawyers who were just starting to practice.
But before you even got to AI, there was a market that was e-discovery, right? How to work through all this unstructured data and just kind of figure things out where the lawsuits were being filed, or you're just trying to get past information. So how far back does this go in terms of what were you doing with all the data that you had?
Yeah, totally. So basically, in the early 2000s, in the wake of the transformation of having lots of paper documents to having lots of electronic documents, and early developments in natural language processing and machine learning, a couple of more innovative law firms, including Wachtell, my friend Mara Grossman was there, started to play around with what they called technology as assisted review, which was using machine learning to build classifiers that would say, is this document relevant for my case? Yes, no. It's kind of like spam classifier. So is it spam? Is it not spam? Does it have the features that include it in bucket A, or does it go in bucket B? And there was just this incipient industry that was developed about, 15 years ago to use machine learning to help large corporations and the law firms that were serving them just classify documents into one or the other bucket.
I just wanted to question you, using the term machine learning, my sense is you're using that because it's a more sophisticated set of techniques than just traditional analytics. Is it because it's unstructured data, or is there even more to it than that, even 15 years ago?
Well, way back in the day, it started off with even Boolean search queries. So you would say, if the document has this word and it has that word and it doesn't have this word or it has this word, and you can imagine you might start off with just one or two words that would be relevant for a case. So say it's a case about, actually, there was one that was pretty famous in the United States government against a large tobacco provider, right? So it was smoking regulations and, you know, whether or not it's okay, and there would be taxes from the federal government. And so you can say, if it contains the word smoke and Marlboro Man and not the following words, et cetera. So they started off with just a sort of rudimentary keyword search type techniques, but the lists got really long. So you'd have these Boolean search queries with like 35 terms, and it was cumbersome to encode, and it was always just these deterministic features. And earlier on, there were some they're not super sophisticated AI algorithms, but we call them naive Bayes algorithms. So some sort of techniques that would go from having a human have to come in and make this list and encode it to having a human be able to give a little bit of indication that this document did indeed have the features that seemed relevant for the case and this other document didn't. And slowly but surely, those, you know, the machine would come to pick up the traits as opposed to having to have them be hand encoded by a person.
Is that, that's not supervised learning yet. Is that right? Is that, this is still early days, correct? Well, that would be considered some form of supervised learning if you're saying this is the document that looks good.
Yep, it was supervised learning. And, you know, even it was early days, but actually supervised learning systems have been in production for a pretty long time. There's some religious debates where they would say this is called active learning. The difference being that either you start off with a training set and you're going to label all the answers all at once and build your model, or you start off, you don't have enough great labels in the beginning. So you start with a couple, do some work, come back, give some more, you know, give some more right answers, and continuously over time train that set.
So we've trained documents, or we've trained systems to extract critical documents. So where are we today in legal industry and AI?
Not much further. A lot of this has to do with the fact that lawyers tend to be conservative laggards on the technology adoption curve. So while the technology has advanced, that doesn't mean that people's use of it has gone, you know, has gone much further than what was possible even 10 years ago.
So they were early adopters for some degree to kind of take some of the grunt work out of it. But we really haven't found a good application for AI. In that case, we still need humans, and we need juries, and we need judges. So we should, you and I maybe should march on to a different industry. Is that fair?
I think it's probably fair. I think that to a certain extent, it's, you know, paralegal type work. Everybody's comfortable with accepting that it's okay to judge if a document's relevant or not. And even there, they're not totally comfortable. There's still some religious debates. But it seems, feel we get a little bit more uncomfortable when it's going to be, you know, automating a judge's decision, or even automating the process of doing research, deciding if we found all the documents that might be relevant precedent for a case. That's stuff that's still sort of a new frontier that's being explored right now.
Interesting. So let's take me through, pick another industry that you think is kind of cool that you could leapfrog from legal into, where you think AI is working a little better. And then we'll see if we can get some characteristics as to what makes that interesting.
Well, I mean, I think we've seen decent adoption in similar type of work to legal in the big four accounting and auditing firms, where similarly, right, you've got a lot of documents that have a very firm structure. So there's not a big difference between one 10K and another 10K. Everybody's following the same format. And that makes them great unstructured data AI type problems, because while they're not just fields in a database, there's a lot of regularity around the type of language that's going to show up in a 10K document, which leads to that level of consistency that make them decent for certain AI automation.
10Ks are great sources of data that you can feed into a model. But once you have it working, how do you look at people and processes?
There's a lot of fear and talk out there that multiple jobs are going to be, you know, people's work is going to be replaced by these hyper intelligent machines. But I always think about processes as both breaking down some task that needs to get done into multiple people doing various parts. And then even each little person in that group of people can break down their work into multiple tasks, some of which can be automated and some of which require a little bit more judgment. So we see that in probably every industry, but certainly in the auditing industry, where there are certain types of work that really do require sort of creative insight. There are specifics of a case. It might be information that comes in at the last minute, and that's great work for humans. And then there's other stuff where they have to sort of go through a checklist. There's 500 questions there. And every time they see the same a document that comes in, you have to say yes, no, or not applicable. Is this compliant with a particular principle? And most of the time, these companies have repositories of thousands of completed checklists, which make great training data sets for machine learning problems.
So in terms of, we talk about legal, a little bit auditing, let's talk a little bit about some of the ethics that sit here in terms of these machines are doing work, particularly around legal issues and auditing issues. So what's your sense of how that's evolving in terms of the trust in the systems? You say, you know, we're evolving now where paralegals can accept the fact that some of this work gets done for them. Where are we, you think, on ethics today on some of this work?
I actually think the biggest ethical issue in industries like legal and auditing have to do with the fact that the systems are probabilistic. And it's like, it's less ethics and more sort of user adoption, where, as you can imagine, if you go to an auditing firm, you want to be certain that your 10K is compliant with whatever standards they're auditing it against, right? They're in the business of certainty, not in the business of probability. And if you use one of these machine learning systems, it'll output an answer that says, we think it's a yes on the compliance checklist with 85% confidence. And the data scientists will be super happy because they've reached such high accuracy rates in their classification. It's like, this is great. We're in the 80s. And then, you know, the users will say, we can't use this. If it's not at 100%, we just have to reject it. And similarly, if you imagine, is this document relevant for a lawsuit? Well, we're 70% sure it's relevant. And even if we humans are always making those judgments internally, we work with a user illusion of certainty, right? We think we're doing things more certain than we actually are. And when we're confronted with this in front of our faces with these probabilistic systems, it leads to a lot of nervousness around their use.
Yeah, one of the principles in our AI white paper coming out has to do with, you know, getting the business knowledge right. I won't have the exact, I should probably get the exact principle here, but if I'm putting an ad in front of you or other people like you bought this, it's okay that I recommended a toaster when you were looking for a broom, or I recommended a toaster when you were looking for a car. It's not the same thing saying we didn't find any cancer in those cells. The risk of failure is significant. And I guess that's something always needs to be managed as you kind of look at the business.
Totally. And going to another ethical issue. So a lot of people these days are harping on the notion of explainability. So we, in using more complex nonlinear models like deep learning, they'll have this amazing performance and we never quite know why. Actually, I really love this joke that my friend Yuri Ivanov from Rethink Robotics told me once, which was, how did the neural network cross the road? And the answer is, we don't really know, but he sure as hell did a good job doing it, right? So this is sort of the, this is an issue that's vexing people because they really want to be able to have answers for why the algorithms come up with the answers that they do. But my take is it depends on the use case. So there's certain ones like an automated vehicle where it's less important that we know why the sensors decided to have it turn left and more important that it has very quick, fast response time and it does what's right for the situation so as to protect the passenger. And then there's others where, you know, we might have the time and leisure to go through and do some sort of forensic investigation as to why an output was made. And so I think it really is a use case by use case type decision process.
You're right. As long as the car gets you where you need to go, or as long as the neural net got you across the road, you're kind of all right from that perspective. The transparency is less important, probably.
I know we talked about Kathy O'Neill in the past, but sort of the typical use cases like consumer loans, mortgages, recidivism, education, employment, that deal with important aspects in individual lives. I think it's pretty important there that people have some justification for, you know, a decision that might impact their future.
So this is a good discussion for me. So you've got product and strategy. You've got a very broad background. And from my perspective over my years, you know, good product managers have to weave together tech. They got to work with the design. They got to work with the tech teams. They've got to work with the business. They've got to represent the customer needs, as well as all the other elements that drive a business like finance. So what's your sense of, when you're building a team around AI, the different types of skills to bring to bear? Because we're now not talking tech, we're talking ethics and transparency and decision-making. So how do you see that evolving where we are today in this new space, in this new world?
That's a great question. And there's a lot of people who ask, should there sort of be an in-house ethicist to help data teams and technology teams think through these types of questions? I think that's probably going to be a luxury position for the long term. I think Google might have in-house ethicists, but I think there's some dialogue in the data science community on building basically a Hippocratic oath for data scientists, where as part of being within this profession, there would be sort of a rubric and a set of maxims around what is ethical and non-ethical data science practices. And then I also think, and it's something that we do at Integrate AI, Tyler Schnibblen, who's already on the podcast, he also has a humanities-oriented background. And we believe in particular in working in applications that involve AI on data about people, that it's super important to know that these aren't just abstract models, but they're people. And as we think through which features to look into in our models and how we're building our products, we always sort of have our first ground foundation, which is, let's do a common sense check and like think about this from a humanistic perspective.
And as you aggregate information of people, what's the right level for conversation with the end users in terms of where they're expected to be with their awareness of what you're doing with their data?
It's just fascinating for me that, you know, privacy has evolved from what it was under the Fourth Amendment, which is, you know, man sort of has the right to his home and his castle. And there's this case in the 1970s, Katz versus the US, where suddenly privacy extended outside of the home to the phone booth, where there was some wiretapping on a phone booth. And it was sort of the notion of reasonable expectations for privacy was born. So the question, I think the really interesting question, one that we grapple with at Integrate, is where is there a reasonable ability to share data, and where do we pass a line where there's a sort of a transgression that is not acceptable? And I think it's something that we're, you know, still in the process of trying to figure out.
So where do you see taking your analysis of data? How deep do you go, and how do you protect individuals' privacy?
Yeah, a couple of things we think about. The one is it's never going to be at the individual level. So historically, in a lot of the DMP providers in the ad tech space, we think about personalization as like, all right, we've got this individual identifier, someone's email address, device ID, whatever that may be. And then we sort of concatenate features across them, like some of the, you know, Equifax, et cetera, have done in the past. And it's a much harder problem when you say, I don't want to be violating privacy, so doing this at the individual level. I'd like to go at the micro segment level. So maybe, you know, anywhere from 500 people to 10,000 people, depending on the size of the population. And I want to find abstract patterns of behavior that can be nonetheless used to sort of join insights across different data sets. And then per work that we're doing together with Evgeny at Georgian Partners, I also want to make these models private using this technique, differential privacy, so that no matter how hard anybody tries, our data science team has a mathematical barrier between, you know, the output of our models and then the individual data that's feeding them. And we believe that that's it really is going to be the future of what privacy looks like in the space.
I think people will be very comfortable to hear what you're doing to both protect privacy as well as not cross that line too far in terms of personal identification. But is there more going on? I think we've touched on how end users deal with uncertain results. We've talked about transparency.
Issues of ethics and machine learning. So we talked about the difficulty a lot of end users have with processing probabilistic results. Talked about explainability in models and the fact that people get a little concerned that they can't ask why a system created the output that it did. And the third one that will come up has to do with the very fact that the systems are trained on data that are, you know, traces of past human behavior. I like to think about it as the time warp of AI systems, where they're trained on the past. And so sometimes they bring forward traces of, you know, the evil things that have occurred in human history back to the fore and potentially could perpetuate that going forward. So an example would be that there was some research by some folks at Microsoft 2 years ago on using word embeddings, which are deep learning techniques to model language, where they started to do these creative word algebra tricks where it would be as man is to woman, so king is to what? And the system would say, it's to queen. And they found when they put that on the data, when we hear that, we're totally cool with it. And it was as man is to woman, so brother is to sister. We'd also feel okay with that because they're socially sanctioned comparisons. But then they found that the system would come up with answers like, as man is to computer programmer, so woman is to homemaker. And as white man is to entitled to, so black man is to assaulted. And a lot of the press that we see around these kind of slips, these sort of social slips with AI systems, will say, oh my God, the algorithms are evil. And, you know, the algorithms are just math, but they're picking up recorded traces of human prejudice.
Is that part of training, or is that it's independent of training? This is the data itself. And then you have to capture, you have to analyze it, catch these errors through training or validation?
Yeah, it's sort of a mixture. So it's in the data itself. They likely are emphasized and brought to the fore in the process of training. So it's not that they're trained to recognize prejudice, but they're trained to be optimized towards some goal. And in doing so, they might elicit and pick out, you know, some of this prejudice that's existing in the data. What we have to do as ethicists is come in and know that this might occur. And then B, and this is where it gets really interesting, the same researchers at Microsoft actually developed a technique where they were able to shift around the structure of their vector, right, which is the mathematical representation of language here, so that it was neutral in any of those socially charged instances. So if it found woman is to sister, it would say, that's totally cool, we're okay with that gender comparison. But if it found woman is to homemaker, it would say, no. This is, in our model, this gender association is removed from the equation. So that, and that's powerful, right? So once we, if we sort of shift around our framework as developers and understand the output of these systems as just observations of what's going on in the data, we're then empowered to like find stuff that we're not okay with and make the changes required to try to get more fair results. It's hard. You can't, those making those changes is not an easy process. Like it takes a lot of, it's actually an active area of machine learning research these days to develop more fair representations. But it's, you know, it's possible, and there's a community that's arming themselves to do things right.
And then you take this team that you've built that has perhaps an ethicist on it, or at least some creative people, then you're bringing back the view of the end user, the hopeful transparency of what you're doing and why you're doing it to keep the right explanation for the right business case. And then it all comes together. We've got happy businesses and happy end users.
What I must say, there's one thing that I find to be the most, I don't know, I want to say pleasing, gratifying. The most gratifying work as a product person is to be able to see and maybe sometimes even synthetically and imaginatively create the parallels between what seem to be two totally different use cases. So I'll give you an example. We've been at Integrate working on what I call a one to many bi-directional recommender system. And what this means is, I know you say like, what is that? So what this means is normally if you think about a recommender system, like an Amazon, where you've got a person and you want to figure out which product to show, a broom or a plunger. And you know, you'll go through and do some comparisons with other people that have behaved like that person and bought similar stuff in the past. And then you, this technique called collaborative filtering, you end up presenting the object. The object doesn't really care. We assume it's inanimate. Maybe in the IoT enabled future, it won't be. But currently, you know, they don't really care much about us. We just care about them. But when there's interactions between people, the person that's recommended, the experience, the situation, the group, also has feelings and also has perceptions and tastes. So it's not just that it matters that I like you, but also you like me in order for it to be sort of a successful online dating app, let's say, as one example. And that gets really interesting when it's maybe groups that might collaborate. So I was talking with somebody yesterday who's got an educational app, and they're trying to optimize study groups. So it's, you know, who will be great learning partners with one another. And because of different learning styles, that will vary based on the perspectives that people bring to the table. We have a couple of use cases that we're thinking about that are basically optimizing experiences together with groups that we hope will lead to maximum lifetime value for our companies that we're serving, because people have great customer experiences in these groups. And it's been really gratifying for me to see different problems pop up where I didn't anticipate that this would be something that would be so universal, like and universally translatable. But it might be. And it's great to form a product where you start off with, all right, we've got this model, we've got that model. And then slowly but surely you sort of coalesce on what might become the core capability, and it sort of defines the future of the product.
Fantastic. So Catherine Hume, thank you so much for being with us today. It was a pleasure chatting with you and seeing you again.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for having me.
We've chosen applied artificial intelligence as one of our thesis areas because of the profound impact that technology will have on every company producing software solutions. And there are a lot of components in an AI solution, and you don't really get to select just a few to focus on. My thanks to Catherine for taking the time to be with us today. By the way, I recommend her newly minted podcast, In Context. In the first one, she has an interview with Professor Richard Sutton. And I'm not kidding you when I tell you he wrote the book on reinforced learning. So if you're interested in how AI models learn from supervised to reinforced, give it a listen. We'll post a link to that on our podcast page for this episode. For the Impact Podcast, I'm John Pryle.